Good morning, this is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Amitai Etzioni, University Professor at George Washington University and founder of the Communitarian Network, and our topic is the significance of community. Dr. Etzioni, glad to have you on the show.
I'm delighted to be with you.
A lot of people think of themselves primarily as individuals, that they're concerned primarily with who they are, what they want, or perhaps what they want for their family. And they think of the state primarily as a place in which they coordinate their efforts with other individuals, and perhaps the state's a way of adjudicating between competing claims between individuals. I take it you think this is a mistake. And I wonder if you can briefly explain why, and then we can go back and look at the elements of your answer later in the interview.
Well, a very important part of our life takes place in a third place, which is neither the rugged, isolated individual, nor the state. I grant you that's kind of somewhat soft and fuzzy, and therefore we not always think about it, but our neighborhoods and our friends and our ethnic groups and our churches and our synagogues and our voluntary associations, of which there are many hundred thousands, are all part of this third sector of the community, which has enormous importance in our life.
And how would you describe that third sector?
Well, it's the places we bond with other people. Again, I can go through the same list. Like when we are joining, if gay people join a gay community, there are intellectual communities, there are many, many ethnic communities, Korean Americans, Jewish Americans. This is a very important part of our fabric. Communities, people who are members of communities, we have some very, very strong evidence to show, live longer lives, happier lives, and healthier lives than people who are not member of any community. That's a very strong claim, which is supported by a lot of evidence.
Okay, and I take it, too, that on your view, the idea that we're just individuals somehow fundamentally misunderstands what we are. That on your view, we're not just little atoms that happen to bump into one another.
You're absolutely right. And I believe on second thought, very few people really think that way. I never met an individual. I met a woman who is an Irish-American from Minnesota, and you will see in her all those attributes. Or I met a young man from southern China who is a Buddhist or whatever. So if you ever meet a person, you immediately see all their social fabrics reflected in them. Now, it's of course true that on top of that, they're not simply reducible to their social categories, and they are form some individual attributes on that background, but to a very large extent, their starting point and much of the rest of their life is really reflecting the social context in which they're born, in which they grew up, in which they live now.
How did it happen that we came, at least theoreticians, but I don't think just theoreticians, came to think of ourselves primarily as individuals separate from these communities?
Because at the beginning of Enlightenment, communities were overbearing, and there was Salem in Geneva, and there was somewhat like Japan today. There were very overpowering social pressures, both by the communities and by the church and by the king. And philosophers, John Locke especially, start creating an ideology whose purpose was not to destroy community, but to roll it back, so make it not so all-encompassing and not so oppressive. The whole idea of liberalism not in the political sense of today of Humphrey and Como, but in the political theory of the sense, the people who emphasize rights in individuals, basically want to roll back the government and protect us from excessive intrusion into our lives. But they never meant for a second to suggest that we should not have bonds with other human beings. On the contrary, the best protection against overbearing government are strong community bonds.
All right, when you talk about the importance of community in identifying who we are, could you give some more examples? I mean, ways in which the communities define our aspirations, define our moral understanding, define the sense, our sense of who we are.
Well, just close your eyes for a moment, or you, or the people who are with us today, and think you were born in a small village in Guatemala, son of a small farmer. You think your ideas and your views and your concepts would be the same that if you were born on the left bank in Paris, or untouchable in India, or an Israeli on a kibbutz next to Tel Aviv. So once you think about yourself in context, you see how much of what you are is really, at least initially, given to you by your parents, by the community in which you were born, the culture which you belong. Sure, we like to flatter ourselves that we are individuals, free thinkers, we never been influenced by anybody. All right, it might be easy to look at the other person. Look at the person to your left and to your right, and it's inescapable. But we're not determined, we're not completely shaped by our social environment, but we are profoundly influenced by it.
And that influence is not bad. It's not just that we're influenced and, how terrible that is. It's that influence, in fact, is very important and typically very positive.
It can cut both ways. If you do not have a solid and healthy community, and most people are so deeply in need for community, if they don't have one which is wholesome, they'll find another one. And that, for instance, they will often join a gang, or they'll join a militia, and so, or some demagogic totalitarian social movement in which they'll find community. So communities can cut both ways. While we need desperately social bonds, if you really create the kind of isolated individuals the theoreticians like to talk about, you'll see they become mentally disoriented too. If you do a psychological experiment, as people have doing that, and take somebody and put them into a room and leave them alone for a few days, they become very, very uncomfortable. If you leave them longer, most of them are going to be in serious mental difficulties. Or when people are prisoners or inmates are put into isolation cells, this is the worst possible punishment, psychologically speaking. So we very deeply need the affection and bonding with others. That is universal, and when we get that, we thrive. Then there comes the question of the content of those bonds. The bonds have both the closeness, the connectiveness, and then they have a moral content. Now, if people use those connections to manipulate us or to dominate us, the same bonds can be used to rather evil purpose. So it's kind of duality we have. You all need bonds. The content of some of them is much better than others.
Okay, so the aim, in your understanding of communitarianism, the aim is to acknowledge the importance of community, but then to make sure that we have communities that are not unduly repressive against us.
That's exactly it. Now, you just gave the very core of our thesis. And so the group which I speak for, there are all kinds of communitarians out there. There's some in Asia, East Asian communitarians, who only want community. But the new communitarians, the group I sometimes speak for, that's our number one point you just made. Rights and responsibilities. Benign, limited communities, not totalitarian, overbearing communities. And the best way to protect us from excessive community is to realize that if you're a member of a community, however viable and strong, your rights as an individual within the community are sacred. So I spent a year of my life in an Israeli kibbutz, an Israeli communal settlement, and they had both. They had a very effective, solid social bonds, and you knew exactly what's expected of you. You were expected to work for the common good. did not get paid, but you were taken care of. So you had clear social responsibilities, but nobody would think of laying a glove on your rights. You have a right to free speech, to assemble. There are evenings, they had assemblies, and everybody could say all they wanted to, etc., etc. So it's perfectly possible to combine a strong commitment to rights and a strong community. Actually, it makes for better communities. Now, true, sometimes these two clash, but in principle, they can be combined.
Well, maybe we can talk then about how to combine those, because clearly that's going to be the difficulty here. Let's look at each of those elements in more detail. I mean, you talked about rights on the one hand, and you talked about responsibilities on the other hand. Certainly, that's a theme which shows up in any number of your works. Two which I have read most recently are The New Golden Rule and The Monochrome Society, for anyone who would like to explore these ideas a little bit further. Let's look at the first of those, though. The idea of rights. What does the communitarian mean by rights? And what role do they play in their understanding of the community?
Well, again, I shouldn't speak for all communitarians, but let me speak for myself. And again, as you correctly pointed out, I could explain that much better in a 300-page paperback, The New Golden Rule. Rights, from my viewpoint, are the way the founding fathers had it, the way the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the United Nations has it. They are self-evidenced truth. I don't need any long explanation or philosophizing why we would like to have the right to speak, to free speech, to privacy, to political expression, to freedom of assembly, and that whole list of enumerated rights we are all quite familiar with. They are just the rocks on which our freedom and autonomy and human dignity rest, and they're incontestable. Now, the only way I can take it on from here, if you allow me to bring in for a moment the other side,
sure,
so I can discuss what happens when they clash. So let's give an example, the freedom of speech, and then somebody makes some very offensive, vile, hateful speeches. It's a famous category. Hate speech is a famous category. And now people come and say, my God, that will offend the community, offend its members. We should not allow that person to speak. And indeed, Canada and Britain and Germany said, you can say anything you wish, but you can't have, you're not allowed to have hate speech. So they would limit that right in order not to offend some segments of the community. I don't buy that. I would say that indeed, as the ACLU would say, the whole purpose of the First Amendment of the right to free speech is to protect speech people don't want to hear. I don't need the First Amendment. I want to give you compliments. So what would I do about hate speech? I would say, if let's assume you say something offensive, you make a comment about blacks or Catholics or Jews or what have you, I'm perfectly entitled, individually and as a community, to come and say to you, what you just said is terrible, offensive, troubling. If you go on speaking of this, I never want to lay eyes again on you. I'll never have you over for dinner. Shame on you. I have a right to free speech, too. And so I would correct hate speech by more speech and by community speech. I would explain to people the difference between your legal right to say things and the moral rightness of saying certain things. Things can be legally right and morally wrong. Hate speech is legally right and protected, and morally wrong by the standards of the community. If that doesn't help yet, if we can still not get people who engage in hate speech to stop that way, then, let's say on the campus, I would cancel all the classes for 2 days and have a college-wide assembly discussing why that particular speech was offensive and inappropriate, but I would not make it illegal.
All right, so to that extent, the communitarianism that you advocate looks very similar, at least in that regard, as someone who is a very staunch defender of individual rights, perhaps at least in some ways more staunch than many individuals in our country.
Well, I'll, in a moment, beg to differ. It's like, well, let me first get out of the way where there's a difference, and then come to a more important point. Usually, the people who are simply rights advocates don't talk about the right of the community for corrective speech, because the concept of community doesn't even exist in the standard individualistic libertarian literature or political theory. So they basically would say, there's a lure and such. Freedom of speech is what we need. If it upsets you, tough. You have to bear it because it's good for the freedom of speech. I say the only thing I add to their commitment to my, yes, staunch support rights, is we have a right for counter speech, not to hit them, but to try to correct them through educational persuasive means. But you're right. The most important difference is not in our commitment to rights, but then we bring in the other half of the story. And let me put it differently, because that gets us to the main point. You think about it for a moment like this, that half the world, actually much more than half, talks about responsibility. The Chinese, the Japanese, much of Islam, much of Judaism have one thing in common. They have very little room in their ideologies, philosophies, beliefs for rights, for individual autonomy. They all talk about the obligations to the community. The West, by and large, has locked in on the other half of that story, on rights. And the communitarians I'm talking about, taking these two global voices, those who call for attention to the common good, to community, to responsibility, and are unmindful of rights. And those who are mindful of rights and pay no mind to responsibilities, and combine them in a new balanced philosophy which calls about rights and responsibilities, autonomy and attention to the common good. So you see our newness only if you put in the context of a thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. We're synthesizing rights and responsibilities.
Okay, I'd actually like to talk about that synthesis toward the very end of the show, but let me just get you to say a little bit more about this notion of responsibility, because I take it you think that's something that's been largely missing in, at least within public discourse in this country. So could you say a bit more about what you think we need in the way of responsibility, what we need to say about responsibility, how we need to try to inculcate personal responsibility?
Well, I started this whole project in 1990 when I was teaching ethics at the Harvard Business School, and I came across a study which since then kind of guided my thinking. It's kind of it's a little piece by itself, but it's like the apple which we are told hit Newton's forehead and kind of got him to see the force of gravitation. The study I found was that young Americans feel very strongly that they have a right that if they're charged with a crime, they can demand that they come before a jury of their peers. And it's a very important right to us. But when they were asked to serve on the jury, and they said, I'm sorry, find somebody else. Now, I argued that time, and still do, that that's first of all illogical. If your peers will not serve in a jury, you will not have a jury of your peers. But second, it's indecent to take the demand right and not be willing to share the responsibility for keeping that system going. That's like saying I would like to have a right to use resources, but I don't have to contribute to the protection of the environment. That's somebody else's problem. And if you all do that, there'd be no environment left. Once I start thinking about that way, I saw it all over the place. For 40 years, the majority of Americans, after study, say that they want less government and more government services. It's the same idea. Give me, and I don't have to give anything back. Why should I pay taxes? But I want more services. So this is the disjunction. It's not one which you had throughout American history. You always had this debate between individualism and what they call Republican smaller virtues or civic virtues. But in the 80s, under the influence of Reagan and Thatcherism and this worship of numero uno, or number one, the self, we got ourselves into this extreme individualism, and we came in as a corrective. to say we need to worry about the environment, about our children, about the common good.
Okay, and so the idea that we take responsibility for our actions is not just something that you want to preach. You want to say that it's actually built into, in some sense, built into what it means to have a right. That if we think that we ought to have a right and that other people ought to have the right, then there are connected to that, tied up with that, corresponding to that, certain responsibilities that we also have.
Two sides of the same coin, that's right. There's a technical point here. One of my colleagues, Anthony Giddens, made him conditional. I don't think your right should be ever conditional. So even if you one day did not get up in the morning or take out the milk or the garbage or didn't vote or whatever, I don't think it's reason to take away your rights, or the other way around. If you came to a ballot box and there was a foul-up and you didn't get to vote, it doesn't mean you no longer have to take care of your children. So both obligations are freestanding. They're not conditional on each other. But for them to be, you're absolutely right. If people will not discharge their responsibilities, you will not have a regime of rights, and vice versa.
All right, let me ask you, too. When you talk about this notion of responsibility, certainly one thing that I find in myself a tendency, and seems to me to be a tendency that other people have, is when somebody else does something wrong, or something that I think is to be wrong, or certainly something that harms me, I tend to say or think of them as being responsible for harming me. You know, perhaps I'll say they're mean or they're nasty or they're cruel. But somehow when I do those things, somehow when I'm insensitive, don't listen, overreact, I tend to find an excuse for my behavior. And so I want to have rights and I want other people to be responsible. But I tend to not want to take responsibility for what I myself have done. Is that part of what you're talking about? This tendency that we have not to accept responsibility for who we are, what we do, how we treat other people, what we say?
Yeah, that is part of it. Yes, it is. I'm more concerned about doing things which benefit others or all of us rather than ourselves. So we are responsible for our children. Now, I have five of them. They are wonderful. But they can be quite demanding, and it can be quite hard work to get up five times in the middle of the night to take care of them. And so I cannot do this all the time because I enjoy every minute of doing that. But I have a sense of responsibility, what I owe in a moral sense. My children, I brought them into this world, and I have to help them grow up proper. When I drive on a highway and other people drive, I have a responsibility to the other human beings who are using the same space. And so I have a responsibility to maintain some orderly or safe traffic. When I finish eating something, if I'll throw out the wrapper or the can or whatever out of the window of my car, I'll be acting irresponsibly over the environment. I'll be destroying something we all need to be well. So there's a long list of things, of valuables, of things of value, which we need to nurture, not because they're going to serve me immediately or even in the longer run, but because that's a decent thing to do.
Okay, so we've got about 4 minutes here. Let me see if this comes close to what you're trying to say, that in public debates, we tend to find ourselves faced with two ways of characterizing the problems. One might be called the political conservative way, in which we're interested in civic virtue, but sometimes at least at the expense of individual rights, and you think that's a mistake. On the other hand, what might be called the certain versions of political liberalism, which tend to blame the system or someone else for everything that goes wrong rather than taking responsibility. Somehow what the communitarian wants to say is both those are a mistake. We're part of a community. What that means is that we have rights, but we also have responsibilities.
That's very well put. We have synthesis between these two seemingly conflicting approaches. And so there's some small print, but yes. And then once you accept that notion, then there's a lot of work to be done. I have a whole book just on the tension between your right to privacy, which is very important, and the common good. So, for instance, when we have a terrorist who was caught, and we found in his computer a program to blow up the United Nations or one of the tunnels leading to Manhattan during rush hour, we violated the privacy of the terrorist in order to find out, stop that other action. So often, once we go beyond some very general principles, we do find that there are some areas of conflict and tension between the common good or our responsibilities and our rights, and then they need to be worked out. Sometimes they make us tilt in one direction, sometimes in the other, but we don't get to this final print unless we do exactly what you said a moment ago. We realize that human life cannot be all take and liberties and myself, and cannot be all serve others, serve community, but we need a carefully crafted balance between autonomy and order, between rights and responsibilities, between self and community, and then all the rest is small print.
In the last minute and a quarter here, could you point us in the direction of how we fill out that small print? How do we try to realize this goal?
Well, basically, I have three principles. First of all, I like to know if there's a problem. I don't like trying to reprogram ethics law if there's nothing serious we face. HIV is serious, we need to look at it. Second, once there is a conflict, I like to see if we can resolve it by some voluntary means, by volunteering, by having dialogue, discussions, community meetings, so we'll not have to bring in the law or some major changes in our culture. And finally, if we do need to, I like to do what's called minimally intrusive. Means make changes which are as least offensive to whatever side we need to adjust, the rights or the common good.
Okay, and as you indicated there, the law may play a role, but it's a pretty minimal role in trying to bring about these changes.
The less we rely on the law and the more we rely on moral dialogues and convincing each other, the closer we are to the point where rights and responsibilities can be most best served.
Okay, and the dialogue, in fact, is part of what helps create that community, is that correct?
Exactly. Yes.
So it's not just a way of resolving conflicts, it actually is an instrumental part of what makes us a genuine community.
It makes us into better human beings than we would be otherwise.
Okay. Well, I hate to say it, we're out of time, but I really appreciate talking to you today and taking the time to appear on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And speak today with Amitai Epitsione, University Professor at George Washington University and founder of the Communitarian Network. This is Hugh LaFont for Ideas and Issues. Good day.